what you want me to do is first identify myself.
Okay. What was your name at birth?
My name was Colson Wayne Drummond. At May the 24th, born 1928. And was born in a town called, actually the closest town was Rice, R-I-C-E, 7 miles from a valley called Pleasant Valley, where I was born, in a home where my grandma and other ladies took care of, didn't even have a doctor, and lived in that little valley called Pleasant Valley for at least 7 years. In different places, was forced to move 4 times in that short time because times were not good. It was the Depression and my father could not pay the rent. Then things changed. The Depression was still on. We moved from that little valley down to the Columbia River, about 10 miles away, to another farm, and then, all the time, having no electricity, no water in the house, no indoor facilities for a restroom, we moved again to the town of Kettle Falls, Washington, 40 miles from the Canadian border. And at that point, I was introduced to electricity. Did not have indoor toilets. Did have water piped into the house for the first time in my life. And then my father worked for the Great Northern Railroad. And he went from a town called Marcus, Washington, to Nelson, British Columbia, on the Kootenay Lake, a north-south railroad that ran from Spokane, actually, to Nelson, British Columbia, and returned. He was unable to get very much work, but the war was approaching, World War II. He was called up by the Union Pacific Railroad at La Grande, Oregon, and told him if he wanted to come down, he could go to work firing for the Union Pacific Railroad with a pretty good chance of steady employment. At that point in time, my father and mother decided to move to La Grande, Oregon.
How old were you at that time, and what grade were you in?
Okay, I got this. 1942, started high school, mm-hmm. to 1946.
Well, didn't you move to La Grande for a short period of time, then leave,
yes,
and
sir.
Then come back?
Yes, sir.
You were in the seventh grade when you came to La Grande the first time.
I forgot to mention that I was, when we first came down, I was in the seventh grade, went to Central School at La Grande Grade School, and after doing, the whole family was quite happy that we were down in this great big city, as opposed to where we had lived in our past. And we had all the facilities such as electricity, water, indoor toilets. Pretty happy, generally speaking, but my father got laid off from the Union Pacific Railroad and we went back to Kettle Falls and we stayed up there. I continued in the 7th and 8th grade, partially in the 8th grade, and then returned to La Grande again and went to high school at La Grande.
When you returned to LeGrand, that's when you lived down on Main Street.
No, when I returned to LeGrand, of all things, we went to that place right across from the old Mormon church that's now an office building there on 4th Street and lived there a short time, then went down to 804 Main, where my father purchased this old home, and we lived there then until I and my sisters were out of high school.
Well, then when you started to school in LeGrand, did you find a big difference from where you lived before?
Yes, John, I'm glad you brought that up. Because in the seventh grade, when I first attended school here, the reason I got the nickname Cowboy, I stood up in front of the class and sang Home on the Range. And the city kids here in LeGrand made great fun of Wayne, and from that time on I was called Cowboy because of my rendition of Home on the Range. However, I enjoyed school irregardless of the nickname, and of course eventually did go to 4 years of high school at LeGrand.
Well, What was the first jobs that you had around LeGrand when you got into high school?
Well, the first jobs, my first actual job was Hamilton Motor Company, a Chrysler dealer, who allowed me to work at his service station part-time, and I washed cars and I greased cars and I learned quite a bit about automobiles by working part-time at this automotive center. Time goes along, I continued to work there on a part-time basis, but took on other jobs, but I'm still in high school and I can only have so many hours to work. And later, I also worked in other service stations, Gene Fuller's Union Oil across from Mike Lynch's. But primarily, I, along with some of my high school friends, in the summertime, I iced cars for the Pacific Fruit Express when and before there was not much use of refrigerated cars to ship vegetables, fruit, so forth. And the way they maintained the proper temperature, they used the Pacific Fruit Express cars, which me and my friends drug large cakes of ice. I believe they weighed at least 200 pounds.
Well, there were 300-pound cakes and 400-pound cakes.
I knew they were big.
Can you tell about what time would we get called to work at night?
The unpleasant part of this particular job, although quite good pay and quite manual in the fact that the ice was heavy and we had to pull them down long platforms and bring them across on a short platform on the top of the Pacific Fruit Express car and down into a hold where the ice was stored to allow the cars to be refrigerated. And we were often called at such hours as 2 o'clock in the morning, could be 5 o'clock in the morning, could be 8 p.m. in the afternoon, but when the trains came in, that is when they needed attention, therefore our ICE crew would immediately, or to the best we could, go down to the Pacific Fruit Express icing station, get our big hooks, and start pulling ice to fill in these cars. We did get pretty good pay for that time.
Well, the important thing was that we spotted the ice at where the trains would stop at intervals. We had a chain that the ice traveled on, and
This is true.
We had to have rock salt there as a part of it.
Forgot that.
And fill up the bunkers at the end of these cars.
Yes.
These refrigeration cars.
Very good.
It, like you say, it was awful good money for the first...
People in Le Grand and surrounding areas had went through a time when pay was rather low, primarily just work on a farm putting up hay like a lot of us young boys did it in the summer. But this job paid better pay. We were inconvenient hours, but we felt good because whenever we got our paycheck, it showed that we made better than normal wages.
Well, we had just completed the junior, the sophomore year in high school, so we were fairly young.
God, to say the least. And we were all the men that worked there, John Turner, Wayne Drummond, John Beeson, Frank Thatcher, all reasonably good-sized fellows, because you had to be reasonably strong to do the job.
Well, because of the war, we were doing men's work.
Is that correct? Yes, that's correct. The men had all went to war. I always remember a strange coincidence. Everyone was interested in the war effort, and us young high school boys were the only men in town, unless you were 50 or older. And us boys thought we were taking the place of these brave men who had went to war. Actually, of course, we were pretty young, but as I stated, we were big enough and strong enough to do this type of work. And of course, it helped our pocketbook, allowed us to have things we hadn't had in the past. And we just simply were fortunate to work there, even though we were at inconvenient hours. Our families didn't like it because we were getting up in the middle of the night, middle of the morning, and we're always worried about whether we was going to be able to do our school work. Didn't seem to affect us too much.
Well, in school, was there any particular classes that you had that helped you later on in your life at work?
Yes, a funny thing happened. I was convinced by some young ladies that I should take typing. The men, the boys that I was associated with, generally speaking, thought that was strictly beneath men to learn how to type. You didn't need it. And kind of a girlish attempt, shall we say, at being able to write on a typewriter. However, I was convinced and learned to type with classes that were full of women, and I found that to be fun because there's all these girls around me and they were always coming up and telling me you should do this way and you should do that, and I was getting extra attention, which I didn't deserve. But anyway, I learned how to type. This later on in life was extremely important to Wayne, I will explain here that in called up in the Korean conflict, this ability to type and also later on to run a teletypewriter keyboard similar to a typewriter allowed me to go to work on the railroad as a telegraph operator, radio code, teletypewriter operator, certainly typewriter. And this in turn, while in the United States Army, they found out in checking my records, I was in the infantry. I had done quite well at Fort Riley, Kansas, because I liked guns, was interested in guns. And they pulled me out of a regular group of men after 18 weeks of infantry basic we all knew we were going to go to Korea when we graduated. And on the day of graduation, they called all my friends up, some of them from LeGrand, who went to the Army on a troop train with me to Boise, were now going to graduate, and I was glad I was with an outfit. But when time come, they told the men that rather than going to Korea, they were going to go to Germany. I was thrilled. When they called the names off, my name wasn't there. I went to see the captain of this particular company, and I reported to him as Private Drummond, why wasn't I called? He said, "You, Wayne, are so good with the M1 Garand, 45 automatic, and various other weapons that we have here, not to mention that you won the 1,000-yard shoot against a group from Fort Hood, Texas, and other large encampments. And when you won the 1,000-yard shoot, I put you down to be a weapons expert to train other young men coming through this basic training." I was shook. I had a nice trophy cup, but at that time I would be glad to turn the trophy cup back to the Army and go with the men that were going to Fort Benning, Georgia, and then to Germany, but that was not be the case. So then, one day, while training men to use the M1 Garand, our 30-06 rifle, and submachine guns, Browning automatic rifles, and enjoying showing many men who come from all parts of the United States, some experienced with guns and many who'd never even seen a gun, and it was interesting to me, but one day the captain, another captain from the headquarters company, called me to the office and he said, "Private Drummond, we've just found out in our records here that you were an experienced teletypewriter, telegrapher, typewriter, so forth, and worked in that position for the Union Pacific Railroad." And I said, "Yes, sir, that's true." He says, "Well, we have a terrible shortage of Signal Corps people. The Army needs people in communications, and we are now going to send you to a Signal Corps school at Augusta, Georgia, called Fort Gordon, where you will become an instructor, and it'll be a good thing for you and a good thing for us." I said, "Thank you, sir," because I knew I was going to be an individual infantry replacement in Korea rather than going with a group of men.
Wayne, we are more interested in things that happen in Union County.
If you
it would be all right with you.
Okay.
You were in high school,
right?
What other courses that you studied that helped you?
Oh, good. Other courses in high school, I felt that although they weren't particularly instrumental, I enjoyed everything but mathematics, and unfortunately I was never good at mathematics. Therefore, in getting out of high school, I went to college for 2 terms trying to learn business administration, because my inability to be good in the use of mathematics, I in fact quit college and went to work.
Well, during the time that you were going to high school and working in the service station, there was a gentleman from Walla Walla that you were well acquainted with, Gordon Kelly.
Yes.
And what things did Gordon Kelly ask you to do during the war?
Gordon Kelly was a new and used car dealer and also a wrecking yard at Walla Walla, Milton Freewater area. And he knew I was very interested in cars, and was pretty alert on good, clean, used cars, which there was a definite shortage of around our Northwest. So he paid me to, if I found out that some old gentleman or some young gentleman or somebody is going to sell a good, clean car, go right to the person, offer him a proper price, call me, and we'll discuss the price, and I'll get right over and purchase that car, and you will get a commission for it, Wayne. Well, this worked definitely to my advantage. And in doing that, along with working at the service station, where I've seen many people, many customers come in with their various cars, and when I found out of a car available, even there at that business and around town, I contacted Gordon Keldy, and it was a good business deal for Wayne because it was extra money in the pocket.
Extra money in your pocket. Well, during that time, what was your first car that you had?
My first car, and I had four of them, were 1936 Ford V8 flathead, wonderful cars in my opinion, very fast, and I continued to be a champion of Ford products for years. But the first car was a 1936 Ford four-door black sedan, and it stayed, as I said, interested in Ford V8s, and probably the fact that the 1936 Fords were fast, smooth, could outrun practically anything in the Grand Ronde Valley if you wanted to.
Well, now, when you say outrun, what was the game that was played often, maybe endangering some of the people's lives and your own?
Well, in high school, there was a group of men who weren't criminals, they weren't crooks, they didn't steal anything, and they weren't drunks, but they loved to operate cars, and they loved to play a game called ditch'em. And what we would do, not only did we run races with each other to see who had the best and the fastest car and the most ability, and this was played practically every third night of the week around the town of La Grande, we got a bad reputation from people reporting cars driving fast within the city limits and playing some kind of a hilarious game. And also, the city police knew about us, and more or less were definitely get us playing ditching because of danger involved for people, not to mention ourselves. One of the most interesting things that happened to me, and I was adequate in playing the game. One of the most interesting things, though, we used to go down by the city police station in La Grande, and there was several city policemen, mostly old, much older than we were. I cannot recall our names at this minute, but we used to go by the police station and rev up our engines with dual pipes and no mufflers and whatever, and the police would come running out, jump in their 1942, the most modern car at that time, because of the war they weren't making cars, and they would pursue us, but they could never catch us. Well, this was kind of, to us, this was kind of thrilling. To be honest with you, it was dangerous in its way. I had some of my friends who rode with me, and we played this game even with the police, as I stated, and we used to run to the first gravel road and make a great big bunch of dust and gravel flying and going way beyond the normal speed. This all come to an end when one day I was down in front of our local hand Ford Motor Company, parked at that time in a 41 Ford sedan.
That would have been Walker Motor Company at that time.
I guess it would have. Yeah, you're right. Anyway, a large policeman, I will never forget, he was
probably 6'5" or 6", huge man, had a brand new Chevrolet coupe with the state police emblem on the side, and he parked next to my car, and he got out of his car and come over to me. Still in the car, I said, "What do you want?" And he said, "I want you to get out of your car." And I couldn't imagine what would be the deal. I had not raced down to Ford Motor Company. I hadn't done anything wrong for several days. Anyway, he says, "Come on, I want you to follow me, Wayne." So I follows this giant state policeman. He takes me around to his car, to the driver's side, and I said, "What do you want me to do here?" I thought I was going to be arrested. He says, "I'm going to open this door." He opens the door. He said, "I want you to look inside." So I looks inside this nice Chevrolet coupe, and in the middle, between the passenger and the driver, and on the transmission hump was a huge square oblong radio. He says, "You know what that is, Wayne?" I said, "No, I don't." He says, "Well, you've got a kind of a reputation around here, and you've got some friends. And I'm trying to get the word out to you boys before you really get into serious trouble. This is a two-way radio. From now on, when you're playing some runaway ditch-em game with one of our police cars, city or state or sheriff, we're going to catch you, because this two-way radio allows us to communicate with another policeman or police cars, and we will catch you and we will arrest you. The jig is up." I said, "Well, thank you, sir." And he says, "This isn't the end of this story. I want you to go to your home, and I want you to call all your friends that like to engage in this dangerous game called ditch'em. And I want you to tell them that we now have, all of us, have two-way radios, and the game is over." He said, "I want you to call Frank Rohan, Walt Smoots, Vernon Carpenter," he named a whole bunch. And I said, "I will." And I was severely impressed by the man and the news that he was giving me. So that was the end of our exploiting the power of the Ford V8 down the dusty mountain roads.
A little before that, when same policeman, Raymond Arnold, was on the city police force.
Arnold.
And they had a brand new 46 Mercury in the police department.
Beautiful car.
Can you say what happened that particular night I'm referring to?
Well, on one of our games, we knew that the police had a brand new 1946 four-door Mercury. And we knew that it would be tough competition, but as it turned out, we got into a situation where me and some of my friends were running that Ford 36 Ford way too fast in town, and we made a run across US 30 at that time, and down into underpass, is still here in LeGrand, out towards Island City, turn left, went out towards our Riverside Park, and the policeman was doing very good. He was right behind us. And I was going to make a turn, and one of my friends said, "Wayne, you can't, you'll turn her over. You don't have good enough brakes for these mechanical brakes." So I decided to go straight. And when I got to the gravel road that goes towards Mount Glen, it wasn't long until we were willing to go much faster than the police were. However, I do believe it was the next day. I was working at the service station, and Arnold, city policeman, nice man actually,
come over to me and he said, I want you, Wayne, to lift the hoods on that 3640 of yours. I want to see what you've got inside that engine. I said, okay, and I walked over to the Ford, put the hood up. He looked it all over and he says, you mean to tell me that this don't have Offenhauser carburetors, overhead cams, and a whole bunch of things that were just starting to be known about? I said, no, it's just a standard 36 Ford. He says, if I wasn't looking at it, I wouldn't believe it. And give me a talking to about no more ditching. This was prior to the state policeman telling me about two-way radios.
If I asked you another question here, the reason that you got into this situation is because you used to take a Oregonian mail paper box and use that as a muffler, and you had a cutout, and that particular night you were going down the street, and the chief of police was going one way, and you let out on it, and he turned around, and no more did you get past him about Washington Street. Here came Raymond Arnold going the wrong way, and you let out again, and went up 4th Street to K Avenue, and turned left up there, went around the college dorm where the girls were, and came off of 8th Street, and when you got to the bottom of N Avenue, here's Raymond Arnold, N Avenue, you turned right, and when you crossed Adams there by the underpass, you were probably doing about 70 miles an hour.
I was.
Then you turned left and went across on Spruce Street there, across the railroad, down Spruce Street to the Black Hawk Trail. The Black Hawk Trail, Dordell Bridge, come back and parked your car underneath your clotheslines at your house. Then we went downtown to see what all the excitement was.
That's absolutely right. I came back into town, snaking, going very, very slow with the lights out. And I knew there was one place I could park that Ford that they would never see me. Even if they come to my house, the Ford wouldn't be there. And I run that black 36 Ford in towards my father's garage and then turn right to go behind the large home in which we lived in and run it underneath the clothesline where if they had searchlights, spotlights, and whatever, they would never see it. And then we all got out and sneaked on foot.
Well, we went to Merton Taylor's car.
I guess we went to Merton.
Who was parked
in the car. I believe you're right. Anyway, the days of playing that game was so much fun at that time, we thought. And admittedly, we shouldn't have been doing that. I do believe that was the closest I ever come to breaking a law of any kind in my whole life.
Well, we're happy to say that nobody got hurt.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. We were very foolish, but yes, nobody got hurt.
Yeah, no, when we weren't into drugs.
Well, when you graduated from high school then, and mm-hmm. like you say, you went 2 terms up college,
yeah.
You went to work at Mount Emily Mill for a short
yes,
time.
Yes, I did. I worked out at the, I guess they called it the Stang Mill at that time, although I'm not positive on the name. I know that Stang was a big lumber executive in this area. And I went to work there, first off bearing boards at a saw location and stacking the boards in a certain way that they were used. Primarily, these boards that I was working with were used to build wooden boxes. But we also cut other sizes of timber. I found out the job was very repetitious, not really hard work, but constantly moving lumber with your hands, your arms, your back, so forth. And a little later, I went to work in a different department called the glue room, where here again men, including myself, were used to put lumber on a machine that spread glue to the sides of the board and made large sheets of boards to be used in construction and furniture and so forth. And I thought that was very repetitious also. And I worked the afternoon shift. I didn't like that because afternoon shifts cut down my social life considerably. I got off work at midnight. Everybody else went home. Anyway, I continued to work part-time at various service stations, even when I was working at the mill part-time. But one day, I was told that there was a job available on the Union Pacific Railroad that I might be interested in. And I decided I would go down and see what the Union Pacific here in our town had to offer a young man like me. And instead of hiring out as a fireman or a brakeman or working on the track gang or whatever, this job turned out to be a telegrapher job for $125 a month. I would go to towns such as Haines, Oregon, North Powder, Oregon, Pendleton, Oregon, Huntington, Oregon, and work as a telegraph clerk, and worked in these various stations to learn how to be an agent for a little town such as Haines.
What did a telegrapher do?
Telegrapher, his duties. Primarily, he was a communication man and train order. He handled train orders for the train dispatcher, and this was just prior to CTC, a centralized traffic control system, and to be short about it, we moved trains at that time by the dispatcher calling up the operator at X station, say North Powder.
But you used a key,
yeah,
operated,
yeah, telegraph,
Morse code
telegraph key.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
That's what I was wondering.
Oh,
what,
yes.
The regular duties, because the people will be reading this won't know what
duties
are.
That'd be so. Well, the telegraph operator, of course, on duty, whenever they give the call sign for the particular station, such as North Powder, was HD. That was the call letter for North Powder. And on the telegraph key and sounder would come four quick dots, then a pause, then a long dash, and two dots, and they would say HD, 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 and then I would answer HD, and the dispatcher would say on the telegraph key, "This is LeGrand Dispatcher, I want you to copy four." That meant for me to copy four orders, thin tissue paper with carbon, addressed to conductor and engineer of a particular train that was coming down the track, but it had not arrived yet. So I would then copy what he said and repeat each and every letter and number on the telegraph key. Then he would say, "Wrap those orders up, put them on a stick," which was a bamboo stick with a Y at the top of it, on a string, "and you hand that up to the engineer, because this means, Wayne, he's going to meet a train at Haines."
He'd put his arm through a cord.
Yes.
To on this Y.
And because the train was not stopping, oftentimes those trains would be making 30 to 50 miles an hour. And the operator, telegraph operator, would stand out close to the tracks, hand this, some people called him a hook, where the engineer or the fireman could reach down out of the cab, get the string and the orders, and immediately read them and find out that he's going to meet eastbound freight, for example, at Haines Playlight. "And you will take siding." So the engineer and conductor would prepare to slow down to head into the siding at Haines and wait for the other train that was on the train order to come by. It was a way of moving and advancing trains. Not to mention that the trains, each person involved on the train crew and in the dispatcher's office and in the telegraph office had a timetable. And numbered trains, if they were due at North Pond at 11:20 a.m., for example...
These numbered trains had right away...
They had right. They had right by timetable to operate on their schedule. Inferior trains were moved against those trains by train orders, allowing them to go further and further. This play like a passenger train was late. So you might have 40 minutes, and they could make, say, Haines in 40 minutes and be in the clear of this timetable train. This allowed us to move trains east and west on the main track, and it was a very important job. And the wind from the big steam engines going by you at 30 or 40 or 50 miles an hour, the wind blew your pant legs. It was like you were a kite out there. And it was kind of scary. However, other people done it, I done it, and that was the way it was done. And so I was getting $125 a month to learn more of the station work itself, everything from railway express, shipping. People at that time shipped many things on the railroad, and at these little depots they could take their whatever they wanted to send by train, they bring them there, and we would handle that. We'd also sell tickets on passenger trains, and in particular, the main divisions such as LeGrand, such as Huntington, Oregon, such as Baker, Oregon, such as Pendleton, Oregon. If you worked in one of those larger offices, you sometimes were assigned just to sell tickets on passenger train.
Now this was strictly a seniority job.
Strictly.
So you had a seniority date as an operator.
I sure did, John, and the thing was, it allowed me, eventually they qualified me as a regular telegraph operator passing all rules and regulations, so forth, and as stated, seniority date. And then when a particular position come available, I, with my seniority, could bid on it according to the rules of who had the most seniority would get the job. And we had, people don't realize it, but we had telegraph operators at such places as Hilgard, Oregon, certainly Camila, Meacham, Gibbon, to move trains across this Blue Mountains. Very important job. They worked around the clock 24 hours a day. They worked shift work. And, of course, by that time I was getting more than $125 a month because I had completed the learning process and became a regular operator. Time went on for me. I was able to work in the LeGrand ticket office where I ran teletypewriter, copied train orders, used the telegraph wire, a considerable amount of that, and secured Pullman bedroom, various types of accommodations on our passenger trains and our streamliner trains. People here in LeGrand, businessmen such as Dave Baum and other important figures at that time, used railroad transportation. Because here in the winter, you could get on a train, for example, at 8 p.m. at night, go to Portland, and they would switch your Pullman car out where you had a bedroom, and at 9 o'clock they'd come and wake you up and say, "You're in Portland, sir, and you have to vacate the car." But it was luxury for these people who use train transportation. They didn't have to get off the train even if it arrived at 4 o'clock in the morning. They could stay right in their bedroom until 9 o'clock. Good little things like that. Well, time time continues to move on, and then I was allowed, they thought for some reason that I had a possibility of learning train dispatching. I went over to the train dispatcher's office next to our Union Pacific Depot and started to learn how to be a train dispatcher and move trains under centralized traffic control.
Now, can you give us a detail how this was done? Because these are people that don't know how this process works.
Well, I had a... just a second here. The dispatcher's office, centralized traffic control in La Grande, Oregon, was the first centralized traffic control, and this office allowed signals, red, green, and yellow, along the railroad right of way for the train operator or engineer. He could run without the use of train orders to tell him where to go or the timetable. He was governed by the display of signals. If it was green, he could run his authorized speed at green. If it was yellow, it was reduced speed, and he reduced the speed of his train to 15 miles per hour and prepared to see the next signal, red, stop, and another signal right below it that indicated he would take the siding for an oncoming train.
Now, this was all displayed on the board.
Yes.
In the office of the Grand, so that
the operator
could follow it.
The operator of the CTC in movement of trains had a huge electronic board with signals and switches for each and every siding, and it allowed him to play like he had electric, this is just for you, John, allowed him to have complete control of the section railroad that he was on. In other words, when a train left La Grande, he gave the train a green signal to leave La Grande Yard and proceed towards Hillgard, Pendleton, Reith, whatever. He immediately started his engines up, pulled out of the yard, pulled off the main line, and went, we'll say, in a westward direction. And then the train dispatcher would display green signals that if he's going to meet someone at Hillgard, oftentimes a train coming down a long steep grade would head into the siding of Hillgard and get out of the way of this train you had just allowed to leave La Grande so that he would have a good run at the oncoming mountain that was Meacham and Camila.
Usually about how big a section of that track was each signal?
Oh, the distance between signals... God, I'm gonna say 1,000 yards.
So how many?
They had many signals that had no switches. They just indicated still green. You're still.
How many dispatchers were working at a time?
Okay. One dispatcher was assigned from La Grande, Oregon, to Pendleton Reith, Oregon. It was called the Mountain, and this was probably. The reason they installed CTC here at this location rather than back in the flat country such as Omaha, Nebraska, Cheyenne, Wyoming, before you come up the big hill, for example, here we had a short, very steep mountain railroad that required the use of extra power, commonly called helpers, and we had to a freight train leaving La Grande might have two steam engines on the front end and another steam engine cut in halfway back in them cars, boxcars and various, and then another one cut in just ahead of the caboose just to get it up to Camila. So because you had instantaneous ability to head a train in, for example, into Hillgard, cut off a helper, add a helper. You could pick up an extra helper at Hillgard to make the mountain. You had flexibility that we had never known, even with all the operators. Here, you had something like, play like you had an electric train set for little boys to operate. Here we had a train that was not a toy, that governed all movements on the track between Le Grand and Reith, not to mention...
Visually,
yes. You're visually looking at lights showing the path of the train as it went along the main line of the railroad or in the sidings. And even if you were a section man and you wanted to put on your little flat car on the railroad track, he had to call you, the train dispatcher, to get permission to set his little flat car on there, and he had 22 minutes to make Hillgard to such and such play light.
Or motor car.
I should have said a motor car is what I should have said. Therefore, when his time was up, the operator of this motor car had to take that car off of the track because he had ran out of time. And he didn't make the station he wanted to go to. He had to take that car off the track anyway.
And they had set offs different.
Yes, he did. And the dispatcher would put up blocks between one little place and another little place and say, this track is occupied by a motor car. Do not allow your train, Wayne, to run in to these people who are out there actually working on the track. You had a tremendous amount of responsibility. I worked with I don't know how many section foremen and men that worked on this section, not to mention the railroad communication crews that were called
signal maintainers.
They were called signal maintainers, that's correct.
And then you also had the rock fences that showed...
Good point, John. Even as well maintained as the railroad system, tracks, ties, so forth, even as good as they were, if for some reason even a solid metal bar, such as a tamping bar, or a pipe, a plain piece of pipe, went from one side of the rail to the other side, that would show an occupancy that something was suddenly on the track between Motanic and Hillgard. It could be a slide, such as mentioned. A slide could have come down from the wet hillsides, crossed the track, and blocked the track. The rock and the mud would immediately indicate that there was a broken rail, a slide, or someone that shouldn't be tampering with those two rails, showing me that there's something there. And at that point, I could stop my train, get them on the telephone. We didn't have radio communication, but they had to stop at a signal where there was a phone. And they get on the phone and say, why are we stopped here, Wayne? And I say, because up there at the west end of Hillgard, between there and Motank, there's something on the track, and it's not a train. I do not know what it is, but I cannot let you go until I find out if there has been some tragedy, even so much as a logging truck crossing the tracks, metal touching metal on the two rails, indicating that something was occupying the track.
These were all safety measures.
Absolutely. Yes. So the dispatcher, along with keeping his trains moving, he had the problem of first-class trains, such as passenger trains, troop trains, various things used on the railroad, including the nice streamliners and so forth. It was up to the dispatcher to put these slow-moving freight trains in sidings, allowing the passenger train to have a green light operation where they could go at the maximum speed they were allowed to be on time at their next station or from La Grande to Portland, for that matter.
And what position were you as a dispatcher when you were drafted into the Army?
I was not really a trained dispatcher. I was learning.
You were still learning.
Still learning, and I started working by myself in the year was 1953. I'd been out of the Army since 1952, 1 year, and they installed CTC the first time it was ever used on any railroad in the whole United States, 1942, at La Grande, Oregon, and it operated first from La Grande to Huntington, and then shortly thereafter, they had it installed from La Grande to Reith, Oregon, or Pendleton, we'll just say. And we were the first people on the whole Union Pacific system to have this great way of moving trains. And
now, your job was protected during the time that you were in the service.
Yes.
When you come out.
Yes.
And then, when you started in the dispatcher's office, you worked at the dispatcher's office for how many years until?
Approximately, I worked as a regular trick, that's what they were called, trick dispatchers. I worked a regular shift, and they ran around the clock. Most often, I worked midnight till 8 o'clock in the morning. I always worked, well, primarily I worked the West and La Grande to Pendleton and Reith, and eventually to Hinkle.
They were 8-hour shifts.
They were 8-hour shifts, and you, when you came in there, you were going to be there for 8 hours unless you had a heart attack or something like that major.
Quite a stressful job.
Interesting that you bring that up, John. We were told while working on the railroad, there was a big comment about mental stress jobs in the United States of America, and the average life expectancy of a train dispatcher was 54 years old. Air traffic controller, another mental, very much mental strain, age 58 is his normal life expectancy. And out of this bunch of dispatchers, 14 of them, there's only 3 of us left here in this locality alive, because time marches on. But the point is, most of these men died at a very young age. Some of these men, John Turner knows, they were Jim Gary, Cliff Gary, Sheminsky, I can just name them, Ross Wilson's father, Ray.
Felix
Cavallo and me and Eldon's are the only ones that I just talked to Felix the other day. He says, Wayne, we're the only ones left. His comment, I can't give his comment, I won't do that, because this is on. The job was a fascinating job. I never, ever, even though I went on to other things, which I'll explain here later, I never had any other job as even close to the excitement, to the mental strain, to the satisfaction that you ran trains for 8 hours, and it was a good day, a good night, good afternoon, no problems. Your trains were moving.
What happened to
these are some of the guys you knew
to quit a job like this?
Well, what happened to Wayne? I liked the job real well. I did have to work 6 nights a week, and during that young time of my life, it was not too much fun to never have a Saturday night or a weekend off, because my day off was Thursday. I hated that restriction. The money was far above what you normally could get working in the normal places in this area. It was far superior, and that was the main reason I stayed with it. I also required my family to have to be quiet around the place. I slept in my basement. But the little kids couldn't play, scream, and yell like other little kids could, because their daddy was sleeping. Anyway, to go on with it, after continuing this job and enjoying it and all the things I've stated, they informed me one day that centralized traffic control, the job I was doing, had now advanced to as far east as Nampa, Idaho, not very far. But it would soon. And I said to the people, I'm talking about the people who were my bosses, how long will it be before you have it all the way to Omaha and down to Salt Lake? And they said, sooner than you expect. And I was told that it'd be Hinkle to Portland right away. And I would have to end up living in Omaha, Nebraska, because all centralized traffic control would be handled at the headquarters in Omaha. You'd still be doing the same job, but you'd be sitting in Omaha. You'd be assigned to a section of track, and you'd live out the rest of your life there.
What year did this finally happen?
Now, let's put that down somewhere here. Well, in let's just say it was 1967, and I don't have it right here in front of me for some reason. But anyway, in 1967, the railroad had primarily stopped using steam engines and went to all diesel. We had centralized traffic control. It was a much more modern place than in the past, maybe not as interesting in some ways. But in 1967, they told me that you had to prepare to go to Omaha. I come home, discussed this with my wife. For months we talked about it. Are you willing to go to Omaha and work as a train dispatcher, still have a good job, or what is your feelings, Wayne? And Betty told me that she would go immediately to Omaha with me, but I told her how much I enjoyed the experience of living here in this great Grand Ron Valley, that I hunted, something I dearly loved, I fished, I dearly loved that. I liked everything about this country, and I for me to go back to a flat country like Omaha, where there was no deer hunting, no elk hunting, no many, they did have Chinese pheasants, but that was different, and my wife fortunately said, Wayne, I am working here at the U.S. Bank, and you don't have to.